Migration Conversations is a podcast that invites persons to share their migration stories. Hosted by myself, Professor Jamie Liu, each episode is an in-depth conversation with people who have experienced the Canadian immigration system or other migration regimes up close. We talk to migrants, immigrants, lawyers, policymakers, advocates, and experts. We hope that these conversations shed light on the challenges migrants face through their own voices. Meet Renisa Mawani, Canada Research Chair in Colonial Legal Histories at the University of British Columbia. She is the author of Across Oceans of Law, published by Duke University Press. I speak with Renisa about her research tracing the currents and countercurrents of British colonial law and Indian radicalism through the 1914 journey of the SS Komagato Maru. Welcome, Renisa. It's wonderful to have you on the podcast, not only because I loved reading your groundbreaking work, but because the Komagato Maru is a touchstone in my own teaching of immigration law. And I wondered if we could start with your journey in this research. What drew you to follow this ship's journey through time and space? How did you become intimate with this particular ship? Could you give us a quick synopsis for our listeners not familiar with this story? What, in your words, is the Komagato Maru?
Well, thank you, Jamie, for inviting me to be on your podcast and to be in conversation. I'm really excited to be here. Maybe I'll start with the voyage of the Komagato Maru. So this was a ship that was chartered by an entrepreneur and a railway contractor and rubber planter from Malaya, Gurdit Singh. So he was Punjabi in origin, and he lived in Malaya for most of his life. And so he, in an unprecedented voyage, he chartered a ship with some difficulty in Hong Kong, and then transported 376 migrants, all from Punjab, but many had been living outside of Punjab for, varying periods of time, to Canada. And he had heard from various people that Canada had passed the continuous journey provision, and he had heard from various people that this had been successfully struck down, that the courts had struck it down, and that there was a window of opportunity for him to actually make this voyage. And so he did, and there are varying degrees of, discussion among the passengers as to whether he was being truthful or deceitful. But I actually genuinely think that, based on my own research, that he really thought that there was this opportunity. But when the ship arrived along the coast of British Columbia, the passengers were really dismayed to find that they were not allowed to disembark. And so they sat in Vancouver Harbor, not far from where I am right now, for 2 months, waiting to learn their fate. And what's actually really incredible about the voyage of the Komagato Maru, so this courageous act, but also the ship was eventually deported, only 20 to 22, the numbers are inconsistent. People were allowed to disembark in Vancouver, those who could prove previous domicile. But this is an amazing voyage because it is unprecedented historically, but most of these passengers spent 6 months on this crowded vessel. And so the ship was actually a cargo and passenger ship, so it had been retrofitted several times. And there are some photographs where you actually see passengers, sitting on heaps of coal, right? And to imagine what would it have been like to be in this crowded, very small space for a period of 6 months, never actually touching down on land, but being close enough to see it. And so these are, of course, all the things that I learned after I started doing my research, but I was really You know, this had been a very powerful and moving event in my own history and my own sort of development as a person of South Asian ancestry, although I'm not from Punjab. And I was actually struck that so little had been written about what this ship meant in the context of India. And so that was the original project, is I was planning to actually study, you know, to write maybe a book about what, you know, what was the symbolic and material importance of this ship in the context of Punjab and India more generally. And when I started working on it, this project and doing research, I was actually struck that, you know, as I said, these passengers, most of them spent, a majority of them spent 6 months on this crowded ship, crossing the Pacific and the Indian Ocean and going into the Bay of Bengal. And so little had been written about, you know, these passengers being at sea, and so little had been written about the ship itself. And so that over time became the focus of my research. And I have to say, so first, the book ended up being very different from what I imagined it to be. But as a legal scholar, I think this writing this book has really reshaped my entire intellectual trajectory, because I don't think I ever really thought about maritime law or about shipping. And, you know, these are really central, and yet they're considered to be very sort of peripheral in law school curricula, for example, and in law and legal studies. And so that then became the focus, or the sort of architecture of the book, was to think about what this meant in the context of maritime worlds, and what were the sort of legal regimes that were governing the movement of these passengers, and questions of jurisdiction.
Yeah, you know, it is so wonderful, your work in bringing attention to the fact that quite a number of goods and people come to us via ocean, and yet we don't really pay attention to what that journey is like. And, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, various images and, you know, news sources in public media about migrants taking dangerous journeys across waters and perishing in water, and how, you know, this is a story that's ongoing. You know, it is not just historical, but one that is important for considering, you know, migration and its implications in the ways in which people migrate. And this might bring us to a question I was planning on asking you later, but I think it's a good segue to looking at what you coin as a new research method, if I may say, as oceans as method, right? Your research, as you discuss, repositions the sea as a legal form, right? You discuss the Koma Gato Maru itself as a legal person. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what you mean by oceans as method. Why is it important, after you've delved into this particular ship and this incident? Why is it important to look beyond the ports, to look beyond landfall, territoriality, and national sovereignty in the, you know, traditional or typical sense?
So I'll just sort of reposition your question slightly in the context of some of my earlier work. So, you know, I think the idea of oceans as method was a way of sort of writing against area studies and writing against this kind of the writing against, you know, with what at one time was a kind of dominant way of writing colonial history. So when I was a graduate student and I started working on my PhD dissertation, I, you know, accidentally came across all these records in the Department of Indian Affairs of Indigenous women who were being regulated spatially in terms of their mobility and where they could go. And a lot of this was around questions of prostitution. So, but I was struck when I was going through these series of records, these RG10 records, by how often Chinese men emerged in these narratives. And so that book was really, Colonial Proximities was really trying to write this kind of braided history of colonialism as a project that was about, you know, deterritorializing Indigenous people, but also exploiting their labor and the labor of Chinese migrants. And so I think that's always sort of been my own kind of method, is to sort of think about these braided histories. And when I started, you know, reading, really, I hadn't been reading about oceans. I hadn't been sort of immersed in ocean studies beyond Paul Gilroy's The Black Atlantic and sort of reading around that. But I was actually struck at how generative thinking oceanically was about writing histories, and the ways that it could sort of take, thinking oceanically could take us out of these kind of linear histories of, you know, time and these sort of disconnected geographies. But then I was also struck when I was reading at how much these literatures on ocean regions were really area studies driven, right? So you have the Atlantic, you have the Indian Ocean, you have the Pacific, you know, and then you have these various sea areas, including the Mediterranean. And so the first sort of impetus behind thinking of oceans as method was really about, you know, how do we connect these different histories? And one way could be through a moving ship. And I'll just say that I, you know, this wasn't something that I sort of thought of until I'd been sitting in the Guildhall Library in London, plotting all the voyages of the Steubenhoek, Cecilia, and the Komagata Maru, so the sort of the ship in its previous lives. And then I had a friend of mine, Leopold Lambert, do a map for me. And when I was looking at this map, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly the method that I've been trying to envision, how this one ship connects, you know, the Atlantic to the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean, through the Atlantic and also through the Pacific. And so I was just, that became a really sort of important orienting device for me. So that's like, you know, thinking geographically and historically, but I was also struck at how often when we think about global time, we think about railways, right? So that's the sort of origin point of thinking about global time. And I was also really struck to see how central shipping figured in thinking about the world as a kind of, or the globe as a kind of temporally differentiated space. And so, you know, Oceans as Method is also about thinking temporally and not just geographically or spatially about, you know, about oceans, about their role in creating these colonial artifacts that are still very much with us today, which is why there's a 3-hour time difference between you on the East Coast and me on the West Coast. So part of it was to, you know, reorient our starting points. What does it mean to start with oceans instead of land? That's not to say that land is not important, but I think it takes on a different significance. What does it mean to start with time rather than space? And what if we actually think of the globe as this undifferentiated, you know, entity that has been divided and recreated through latitude and longitude, for example? And so now, I think, again, I think this idea of oceans as method, I mean, people have sort of pushed back and said, oh, this is not a method, it's an orientation. But, you know, I think for me, I teach my students in terms of not making the distinction between theory and method, right? That it, these both very much inform one another. But I think, you know, this has really profoundly reoriented the way that I think even about land and about territoriality. And it's interesting to think about the ways in which maritime legal regimes have then been transposed onto land in ways that result in colonial dispossession, for example.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the most illuminating parts of your book is just how, you know, when we, the materials I had used to teach the Komagata Maru really focused on the ports of entry, right? And how there was this much bigger story happening during its journey out in the water, right? And that there were other things that were perhaps neglected or not addressed in the story. So I think in some ways you've brought to life a richness to the, and a completeness in some ways of what was happening in between the ports of entry, you know, the times in which we didn't contemplate as being important before, but are profoundly informative in the ways we think about colonialism and movement of people and certainly identities. And tied to that, I guess I want to return to a central character in the story, Gurdit Singh. You begin your book by talking about this one particular individual, his aspirations, his business acumen, his political beliefs. Why was it important for you to also provide this in-depth profile of Gurdit and other persons in your book? And just from a research standpoint, I'm curious about how you were able to glean complex things like his desires from a historical archival record.
That is a great question. So I'll just start by saying that, you know, whatever I had read about the Komagata Maru had described Gurdit Singh as this wealthy businessman. And as I started writing and I came across all of these amazing records in the British Library, and most of them were accusations about him and, you know, and accusations about his intentions. He did actually write a diary in Punjabi, Zulmi Kata, Zulmi Kata was, he wrote a diary on the ship, which was confiscated in when the ship landed outside of Calcutta, and we haven't been able to find, that diary. There are pages of it surviving that are translated into English, but then he wrote a sort of reflection on his voyage, and that was published in Punjabi. And then he wrote another version, which was translated into English, called The Voyage of the Komagata Maru, Indian Slavery Abroad. And, you know, as I was researching this book, I literally became obsessed with Gurdit Singh. I think some of the critiques of my first book were that, oh, there's no people in there, right? You're talking about like Chinese and indigenous people as though they're these abstractions. Part of that was because I was trying to trace these colonial processes. And so from this book and from my obsession with Gurdit Singh, I've like realized how important biography is to telling these kind of, larger colonial legal histories. I don't think I was sort of thinking speculatively or trying to be really innovative in my historical reading. I mean, I have written more theoretical work around Law's archive and the sort of gaps and silences. But I don't think I was actually trying to do anything too creative or innovative in the way I was sort of presenting Gurdit Singh. It was really just that, you know, there are these real people that are not just, that we can't just sort of, that are complex, that are, you know, full of contradictions, and we can't just say, oh, he's a wealthy businessman, or, you know, the other person in the book is Hussein Rahim. And my interest in these characters is ongoing. And so I do have another book project that will feature the two of them and some other Indian businessmen. And, you know, part of that project is to think about, what if we identify these men who have been sort of singled out as dissidents and revolutionaries? What if we identify them as also as entrepreneurs and business people, right? What kind of narrative can we tell about the colonial states in which, you know, against which they were fighting? What can we also say about their own sort of subjectivities? And what can we say about the relationship between colonialism and, between colonialism, anti-colonialism, and capitalism? I've now just, like, biography has just now become a really important part of, certainly of the next couple of projects that I'm working on.
Thank you for that. As you were talking, I was thinking about how so often the way that migrants or how people are categorized as foreign nationals, they're essentialized, they're kind of faceless, nameless. And I thought it was a very, you know, wonderfully complex and nuanced profile that you provided, Gurdit Singh, and just so important that it wasn't, you know, as black and white as you say, as depicted in other accounts, simply because of the ways in which colonial narratives are recorded or documented by certain people at the time, right? But I love how you disrupt those narratives, particularly in this book, and provide, I apologize if I'm not depicting this in a way that you had intended, but in some ways, you know, disrupt this kind of this reflex to categorize people or to pigeonhole them in a certain way. And I think one of the most important contributions of your book is your discussion about indigeneity, how it's deployed, how you say it's differentiated from migrant, and how you identify alternative narratives of Indian radicalism, and how some of the characters were really challenging a white imperial citizenship. And I wondered if you could explain that a little bit more, given, you know, your interest in providing nuanced profiles of persons.
For sure. So, I mean, I think, so when I was doing my doctoral work, I had planned to do something very different. And I had planned to extend the work that I had done at the master's level, looking at public health campaigns in Canada in the sort of interwar years. And one of my classmates was an Indigenous woman and insisted that if I was working on questions of public health, that it would be, it would be irresponsible for me not to think about Indigenous people and how they have been targeted by public health campaigns in, in the early 20th century in Canada. And that's why when I went to the to Ottawa, to the National Archives, I was looking through the RG10 records. And so I think in many ways, you know, a lot of my training really sort of has encouraged my teachers, the people that I've gone to graduate school with, have really encouraged me to think about the importance of Indigenous people in migration histories. And so I wasn't, you know, again, I wasn't, I thought this was going to just be a book about the ship. And when I started sort of reading some of the documentation that I had collected from archives and from, databases, I was shocked at how regularly indigeneity sort of emerged. And I think it's important to note that indigenous people don't emerge in the story, but indigeneity becomes this kind of strategic trope. On the one hand, it's being deployed in India as a way of, as a form of anti-Blackness. And then we see the way it's being deployed by other sort of onlookers in various places in the empire who are, many of them are Indian and who are making, offering these really complicated and really compelling critiques of white imperial citizenship and whether the Dominion of Canada actually has sovereignty over the land that it claims that it has sovereignty over. And so you see the way this very powerful anti-colonial critique is sort of emerging through concerns about Indigenous people. And, you know, you see the ways in which people, these Indian, mostly men, are making, drawing connections and connecting the dots around the British Empire, right? So they're talking about what's happening in New Zealand, they're talking about what's happening in Australia and South Africa, and they're connecting that to the voyage of the Komagata Maru. And so I really, you know, I didn't want this to be valorize or celebrate any of the figures in the book. I really wanted them to appear as complex and as troubling and as troubled, because that is the messy place of anti-colonialism and of, you know, critiques of power, right? We're never outside of it. We're, you know, we ourselves are composed of power relations. And I was trying to really sort of keep that realization front and center, you know. And I think part of it, I mean, these are really complicated questions around who is a migrant, who is an Indigenous person, and what are the responsibilities and sort of ethical priorities that migrants have when they're living on occupied and occupying Indigenous lands. But I also, you know, feel uncomfortable and also a bit unsettled by the sort of dichotomy of settler and native, or settler and Indigenous, that if you're not an Indigenous person, you're automatically a settler. And, you know, I think that there needs to be a much more nuanced discussion about this, in part because I think many migrants are, you know, who are arriving in Canada are themselves displaced and fleeing from histories of violence. And so I think part of the book was trying to sort of encourage or invite a different conversation about, you know, migrants and Indigenous people.
Yeah, I really value your nuanced discussion about that, because I think it is important to complicate the colonial figure, whoever that might be, right? And in talking about colonial figures, you bring to life another legal person, which is the ship. And I find this so fascinating as a legal scholar myself, that you map out the journey and reveal the multiple identities that the Komagata Maru, the ship itself, had over time, and how you use this to define the ship as a legal person, and how it has been implicated in circuits of colonial, imperial, racial terror. I wondered if you could talk about that. You talked a little bit about how you had a map created, that you pinpointed journeys and things like that, but I wondered if you could go deeper and talk a little bit more about how it led you to these multiple identities and circuits.
For sure. So when I was thinking about, I'll have to say this was like one of the most exciting things for me, was to think about the ship as this kind of juridical form, as a character, you know, in the voyage itself, as opposed to just a means of transportation. So when I started working on this book, I was thinking about sort of, you know, larger debates around the freedom of the sea. But I was also very aware that any kind of legal history of oceans and ships really needed to account and engage with questions of transatlantic slavery and, you know, or, you know, ocean slavery. And I mean, I think one of the interesting ways in which I was able to limit my discussion was that this ship, as the Stubenhoek, was actually going from German ports of call to the eastern seaboard of Canada, what is now Canada and the United States. And so I started thinking and reading as much as I could around the Atlantic and around transatlantic slavery. And, you know, and really trying to immerse myself in maritime contexts. And so I read a lot of Joseph Conrad, and I was also, you know, reading all this work about the British Navigation Acts and the ways in which, you know, ships were actually considered to be feminine figures in maritime custom, and then how they became legal persons in Anglo imperial law. And so, you know, there's a really, and I think, and Conrad himself actually identifies this, you know, when he says at one point in The Mirror of the Sea that a ship is not a slave. And so that phrase just really stayed with me. And, you know, I wrote this chapter on the legal person, the ship as a legal person. And then since the publication of the book, have written about the ways in which ships and slaves figure in U.S. jurisprudence, and, you know, how the personhood of the ship is related to the denial of personhood for enslaved people. And so there are these like really kind of difficult and also troubling, deeply troubling relationships between the ship and enslaved people and, you know, what we think of as personhood today. And then as I was reading, I was like, oh, wow, you know, there's been so much work done on the corporation as a legal person. And there's like that, also that sort of part of the narrative. And we can think of the ship as a corporation, or we can think of the joint stock company, you know, that's gaining sort of prominence. And from sort of 1600 onward, we can also think of the ways in which, you know, corporations like banks and other financial entities are involved in shipping and slavery. And we've seen Lloyd's and other UK banks apologize for their involvement just a few years ago as a result of Black Lives Matter. And so I think that there's so much more work that needs to be done, sort of mapping these connections. You know, and for many seafarers, ships did have personalities, right? They had temperaments, they had, you know, they could decide to do things that would, if seafarers weren't kind, that they could decide to do things that would result in possible shipwreck and death. And so all of these things were just so incredibly fascinating to me. And some of them come out in the book, and then some of them have come out in subsequent projects and little bits and pieces of writing.
Yeah, I really was fascinated with how you discuss this kind of construction, right? This legal construction of this figure. And, you know, it's really interesting, you know, if we situate it in all the work that talks about how people are constructed in law as well and different labels and whatnot, but how in this way, I was just listening to you talk about how it breathes life into an object, right? That is not one of that is of life, right? But it, you give it a different kind of texture and life to it that is, I think, important to think about and situates the context in which colonialization has undertaken over this space. So I have two more questions for you. The first is, you know, your work is situated historically. And I wondered, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, threads that you could pull to contemporary incidences, and especially in Canada, you know, with the ways in which ships of migrants arrive to Canada, for example. And I'm thinking in particular of the examples of the Sun Sea, you know, and I wondered whether you, how you see your work contributing to discussions around contemporary instances like this.
So I think that's a really important question. And and I will say that my work is definitely, you know, obviously I'm really concerned with historical questions, and I'm really taken by historical details and by historical methods. But I also think that it's really important that these histories reflect on something in the contemporary. And so I will say that on the book right here, that there's an amazing chapter written on the Sun Sea and other ships in the edited volume that I co-edited with Rita DeMoon, Davina Bandar, and Sutwinder Baines. And so if people are interested in this, I would highly, highly encourage them to check it out. Okay, so it's written by Nadia Hassan, Salaja Krishnamurthy, and Nishant Upadhyay, and there's a couple of other people as well. And so they're really interested in sort of thinking about the Komagatamaru in relation to these other histories of migrants arriving on ships to Canada. I ended my book in the Mediterranean, and because I was just so struck by, you know, all of these vessels that are not even seaworthy, that are being, you know, that are transporting migrants, like these desperate people from various places in North Africa and the Middle East to Europe, and, you know, the kinds of perils at sea, the ways in which, you know, these boats are left to die. And that comes from the title of a article by Charles Heller and Lorenzo Pisani, who have done this amazing, amazing work, including a photo essay essay that I would really encourage people to watch. And what was striking to me is first the horrendous conditions and how the, you know, the tragedies that happened, the lives lost, all of this was being blamed on these black and brown captains, right, of these unseaworthy boats, instead of thinking about the larger global and structural and colonial conditions that have resulted in, you know, in the unlivability of spaces, which are marked by war and by drought and famine and changing climates and all of these things. And what is the responsibility of, you know, the countries that have actually produced that and enabled that? So I end in the Mediterranean, but I think that, you know, there are people like our contributors in Unmooring the Komagatamaru who are making connections between the, you know, this 1914 voyage and things that are happening in Canada today. So I think those connections and, you know, are really, really important. I'll just also answer this in relation to the, you know, thinking about the legal personhood of the ship. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I'm so still so taken by the ship as a legal person is because in many ways, you know, that is an, that is a after, and I'm putting after in parentheses, afterlife of slavery, right? So we often turn to mass incarceration, to the, killing of Black women, men, and children by police officers to signal an afterlife of slavery. And again, after is in parentheses. But I think, you know, even accounting practices and business practices, even the corporation itself, we could say is, and people have made this argument, is, you know, a legal entity that has been enabled through racial violence, through the racial violence of slavery. And so, you know, 90% of our goods are still transported by ship. This is a huge, huge industry. And a hugely polluting one. And what kinds of insights can we get around, you know, colonial and racial violence if we actually think about shipping as, a set of legal and colonial and technological relations that are deeply embedded in histories of violence?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think, you know, your work speaks a lot to how reproductive these processes are, right? That we can see them in different iterations and different, you know, contemporary forms, and that there are important things we can glean from your research about how we understand what's going on in our world today. My final question is, what are you working on right now? I know you're working on something exciting, and I'd love for our listeners to hear a little bit more about it. And what we can look forward to in your next book, hopefully.
Thank you. I'm like very excited about these next two projects that I'm working on. So the first is a monograph called Enemies of Empire and Commerce and Confinement in Colonial India, Burma, and Siam. And so this book actually picks up where Across Oceans of Law stops. And so the book is really centered on the Ingress into India Ordinance, which I talk a little bit about in the final chapter of Across Oceans of Law, and thinking about how this ordinance was signed in response to the arrival of the Komagatamaru, and in response, signed by the Indian colonial government in response to the arrival of the Komagatamaru, and also in response to growing fears about maritime radicalism and by these returning migrants from, North America, but also from East Asian ports of call, who are, planning uprisings against the British. And this was mostly around the Gathers, right? And so what this book is really focusing on is the way in which this ordinance was actually used interchangeably with the foreigners' ordinance in Burma and Siam against merchants and traders. And so I'm telling this, a kind of history of this ordinance through a case that involves four Muslim brothers who are from Gujarat, the state of my own ancestry, and who follow their father to Burma and Siam, and then are working in the sort of border region of Lower Burma and Upper Siam. And so it's an attempt to tell this kind of intergenerational, intimate, and familial history of this ordinance through their lives. I don't actually have very much material. I have one file on these men. And so the project is also very much about, you know, how do we write colonial legal history in the absence of these documents? And what kinds of histories can we tell about places and people and laws? And what kinds of methods and practices of reading do we need to employ to do that? And what's interesting is that, or what I'm really interested in is sort of two things conceptually. The first is how an ordinance that is signed in response to maritime radicalism and sort of concerns about ships and oceans is then being used in inland mountainous regions. And what is the sort of relationship between these remote mountainous spaces and oceans as these kind of vast spaces of ungovernability. And then the second is thinking about, as I mentioned earlier, the relationship between anti-colonialism and capitalism. And so I'm very excited about that project. And then I have a second book, which is organized again biographically around four figures, two of which are Gurdit Singh and Hussein Rahim. And it's called The Indian Business Directory. And it's so all four of these men were listed in the Gadar directory as dissidents and revolutionaries and problems for the British imperial state. And so I'm taking that, the title is a kind of play on the Gadar directory, thinking about instead of the Gadar directory, the Indian business directory, and what happens when we actually take their business pursuits seriously, and where does that take us? And I'll just give you a little sneak preview. It takes us to land holdings. It takes us to collaborations between white men and Indian men, some of whom are municipal officials. It takes us to tax sales. So there's all sorts of really interesting things that I'm uncovering in this research, and I'm very excited to start working on it.
Wow, those two sound so rich in and of itself. I'm really in awe of how prolific you are, but also how you're able to mine the historical records so deeply and provide such rich and interesting stories for us. Congratulations, and we're looking forward to seeing your work out in the world. Thank you so much for your time, for your insights, and for those of us that are interested in, you know, working in the archives and through historical record, any last tidbits or tips that you have for students or researchers that are following in your footsteps?
Well, you can never do too much archival research. So, I mean, it's, you know, Derrida's, of course, written this book called Archive Fever. And I tell my students and my collaborators that I definitely have archive fever. So I'm actually going to the archives in Victoria this weekend to finish up some research there. But it's, yeah, I love it. It's so much fun just to immerse yourself in a different time and in a different sensibility. And, you know, I think there is something really important about being in archives instead of just using online sources, especially now with the growing interest and trend towards digitization. So if you're interested in doing historical research, go to the archives and, you know, talk to archivists and talk to people about what you're doing, because it's amazing how insightful and helpful, you know, archivists are, but also other scholars who are doing historical work.
Thank you for that. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Migration Conversations is created and hosted by me, Professor Jamie Liu, and produced by University of Ottawa student Adam Levesque. This podcast is made possible by the generous support of Carleton University and the University of Ottawa's Shared Online Projects Initiatives. I want to thank former students June Gleed, Ritesh Kotak, and Rachel McNally for their support. You can find more Migration Conversations episodes anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and a special thank you to all of our guests who have shared their experiences publicly.